As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a History of Egypt podcast interview. My guest today is Professor Anne Rosalie David, commonly known as Rosalie David. Professor David is an emeritus professor at the University of Manchester. Her research specialties lie with mummies, bioarchaeology, and the history of medicine. Within these fields, Professor David has initiated and led many projects investigating ancient livelihoods and pathology. As you will see, this knowledge is abundant and personal, going to the very heart of ancient Egyptian life. My interview with Professor David was organized by Pen and Sword Publishing, who recently published her book, A Year in the Life of Ancient Egypt. This book dives deep into the daily life and world of the ancient Egyptians. Professor David builds her story on real studies from mummies and combines them with texts and art to create a full picture of life in the ancient world. You can find a link to this book in the episode description. I highly recommend it. Now then, introduction finished, on with the show. Allow me to introduce Professor Anne Rosalie David. So, Professor David, thank you very much for joining me on the History of Egypt podcast, and welcome to the show.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. So, where are you based at the moment, and how are things going for you?
Well, I'm based near Manchester in my home, and as you all know, we're all in lockdown, but I'm using the time constructively in that we're writing and editing a new book. So, of us have been in contact over that, so it's going quite quickly, really.
Are you able to give us a hint on what the book will be about?
Yes, absolutely. It's a multidisciplinary study by Manchester and Belfast on a mummy in the Ulster Museum in Belfast, and the book is due to come out next year. So it's been very exciting, really.
Is this the study of Takabuti that was publicized earlier this year?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's the in-depth study, but for, you know, general readership. So hopefully the story will go around the world.
Exciting. And I will make sure to publicize that once it comes out, because that was a very interesting study, and I look forward to reading that. So speaking of mummies, many of my listeners will know you for your work on mummies, particularly your research regarding the lifestyles and pathologies and physical characteristics of ancient Egyptians. First up, what drew you to mummies particularly as the field of expertise you wanted to specialize in?
Well, my background is as an Egyptologist. I learnt hieroglyphs, the history, and I did my PhD thesis on the ancient Egyptian temple. When I had my first appointment in Manchester back in 1972, some work had begun on the mummies in the collection, but it was very much in a sort of amateur way. And I thought, if this is going to be done, we should do it properly. And the then professor of diagnostic radiology, a man called Ian Isherwood, was very keen to help with this. And so we set up the beginnings of the Manchester Mummy Project. And all the Egyptian mummies in the Manchester Museum collection were over time taken to Professor Isherwood's department and x-rayed. So that was the beginning of it, really. I think the mummies chose me rather than me choosing the mummies.
And how many mummies are we talking about in the collection?
21 human and 34 animal mummies.
Oh, important distinction. Yes. Okay. So that's quite a large collection to begin with. That must have been a very hefty workload.
Yes, it was. And the mummies went into the Manchester Royal Infirmary at the weekend when there were not the patient numbers, because you couldn't expect to go in, you know, in the week. So it took time, weekends, over a period of probably about 2 years altogether.
Wow, and it's very intense. So from those mummy studies and, you know, many subsequent research projects, your book, A Year in the Life of Ancient Egypt, has reconstructed some aspects of life for ordinary people living in the Nile Valley during the Pharaonic period. I'm curious about what inspired this work particularly, because it's very comprehensive and it's very sort of big picture at the same time. So what inspired you to write this kind of work?
Well, there were a number of things. First of all, I'm interested in the ordinary people of ancient Egypt, you know, more than the probably the royals. So I think it's very good to look at the comprehensive social setup in Egypt. But also, the book, in a way, is a method of trying to describe what was going on in different professions and trades and circumstances. So I created this virtual family of individuals who had roles within these different areas, so I could use them really as a peg on which to hang these descriptions and discussions. And the idea was then that it would be heavily illustrated from the Manchester Museum Egyptology collections, which it is. And so this gets images of the collection out to a much wider readership. So it was an experiment in a way, and I really enjoyed doing it.
Hmm. And you based many of the fictional, quote-unquote, characters on actual mummies in the collection, as I understand it?
Yes, I had to find names for these people. And so I thought, what better to do than to actually name them after mummies in the museum, although, of course, they don't bear any direct relationship to them.
Sure. Okay, and so you mentioned it as a sort of experiment. How do you feel it turned out looking back?
Yes, I think it worked. It worked well. I think it's very important always to think about these mummified remains as who and what they were when they were living people. And this, in a way, is a way of bringing them to life, if you like, but also getting across quite a lot of facts about ancient Egypt.
Mm. And moving into slightly the more, I guess, detailed or academic kind of aspects, you've published several noteworthy studies regarding the diseases which ancient Egyptians in particular experienced. And just from some of your published articles, this includes conditions like cancer and tuberculosis and arthritis. Now, one in particular that caught my eye was schistosomiasis, which is a parasitic infection that apparently affects millions of people in modern Egypt, but also shows up in ancient mummies. So I'm curious, and I think my listeners would be very interested to learn, is how do you identify a parasitic infection in a mummy or a skeleton?
Yes, this was a major project that we looked at the evidence for the disease in human remains in Egypt in antiquity. And this was tied in with a modern study in Egypt by the governments of Egypt and the United States, because they were trying to look at the disease and its impact in some of the communities in Egypt today. So our study was, if you like, the historical context, because you can show that the disease goes right back over some 5,000 years. So what types of the condition were there? How did it impact on the population? Were there any cures, and so on? So basically, the way of identifying parasitic infestations, including schistosomiasis, in mummies, first of all, well, of course, histology has been the basic method, where you get a tissue sample. This is rehydrated mummy sample, and then examined under the microscope, and in some cases you can see the remaining evidence of the eggs or of the parasite itself still there after thousands of years. So that shows you that the person was infected with a disease. Other methods are based on immunology, where they're looking for the antigen. And an antigen is a pathogen that causes disease in humans. So this was a method used by other researchers for trying to identify the disease in ancient mummified remains. And this was really very successful. But when we started on our project, we needed, first of all, to have a relatively large number of tissue samples and a relatively cheap method of looking at all these samples. So one of our researchers developed a technique used for modern medicine called immunocytochemistry. And that actually shows up the evidence for the antigens in the mummies. And this was very, very successful. And in fact, she then went on to use DNA to prove the evidence of it being there. And she found evidence of the first identifiable parasite, the DNA of this parasite, in one of the mummies. So she was able to look at whether the genetics of the parasite had evolved over the millennia, which, I mean, they haven't. But so that was a very interesting development, really. And this technique, immunocytochemistry, can be applied for other parasitic conditions as well. Now, in skeletons, it's more difficult in a way, because you can either look at the skeleton and you may see evidence of lesions in the skeleton, which would be a secondary development from the parasitic infestation. Or sometimes you take it further and use X-rays to look again, and you'll see that these areas can be identified. So in a way, you're looking at the second stage of the infection.
Okay, and I'm personally not familiar with schistosomiasis as a phenomenon. What are the symptoms of it, and how does it affect a human being?
There are different types around the world. The two that you get in Egypt today, one affects the bladder, one affects the liver. Now, we know that in antiquity, the bladder one was present, but we've also been able to show that the liver version was as well. So they impact on those organs. Basically, the parasites enter the body, and it's their impact on the body which causes the disease. So, for example, with the bladder version, which is known today as Bilharzia, you get blood in the urine, you get a whole range of other conditions. So if they're not treated, they are very debilitating, and ultimately, in some cases, they, of course, cause death.
So for the ancient Egyptians, who are working with a very different set of medical tools and a very different body of knowledge, how would an ancient Egyptian physician treat this condition or parasitic infections generally?
Well, we have some 12 so-called medical papyri from ancient Egypt, which give prescriptions which were used in ancient Egypt. This is only the tip of the iceberg, of course, because if you think 12 papyri from some 3,000 years of history, there would have been others. They've been destroyed or not discovered, or they may be in libraries and archives, but just not identified as more medical papyri. But anyway, we have these 12 documents. So from within those documents, there are prescriptions for different kinds of disease. And for example, for the parasites, they have a whole range of treatments for parasitic conditions. So these get rid of the gastrointestinal, they rid the tract of the worms, basically. So some of these remained in the pharmaceutical practice, modern pharmaceutical practice, until some 50 years ago. For example, there's one which was made from pomegranate, and that was in use. And then you have the laxatives such as castor oil and figs and fruit, and gypsum, which is similar to kaolin, which was used to cure diarrhea, basically. But with schistosomiasis, the thing that puzzled us was that from the samples that were studied in Manchester, some 70% proved positive for schistosomiasis. So this, without a treatment, should have been a very debilitating condition. But there they were, building tombs, temples, or whatever. So they were obviously highly active. So we began to ask ourselves, did they have a treatment? And this led to a three-year project that we had on pharmacy in ancient Egypt. And we looked not just at these medical papyri, but also at ancient evidence of plants and the availability, what plants would have been there in Egypt in antiquity, either in the country or possibly imported. And we identified what was probably a treatment for the condition, which is balanitis oil. Now, this again, in the recent past, in modern times, has been used as a treatment for the condition.
Mm. Fascinating. Goodness. So the ancients had a range of methods for tackling infections like this?
Yes, and one of the really interesting things we discovered was that although it had always been said that a lot of these were based on magic or placebo, a lot of them are rational, reproducible pharmaceutical treatments. And also these were in existence hundreds of years, literally, before the Greeks wrote about treatments, and they were always called the fathers of pharmacy. But in fact, they weren't. They took a lot of what they had from the ancient Egyptians.
Mm, fascinating. And out of curiosity, in the mummies that you studied as part of this project, had any of them possibly died from the infection, or had any seemed to go into a form of remission, if that's possible?
It's very difficult to tell. It's not usually possible to identify cause of death in a mummy. You can look at the diseases, you can speculate. Very occasionally you can see what probably would have caused death. But in these cases, they had other diseases as well. And in some cases, they lived to a relative old age. So what they may have been would have been sort of milder but chronic conditions of schistosomiasis. But it's not possible to be 100% sure.
That makes sense. Hmm. So another one of your recent studies tackled the question of cancers in ancient Egyptian mummies. And I was immediately curious to what extent medical texts from Egypt refer to diseases that might be cancers and or similar afflictions.
There's a papyrus called the Ebers Papyrus, one of these medical documents, and that has within it a section on what are loosely translated as tumours. Now, we don't know if these are really tumours or whether they could be something like varicose veins, for example. The translations are not specific enough. It is possible that the Egyptians identified some kind of growths, and it's unclear whether they differentiated between growths that were benign and those that were malignant. But what all the evidence that we and others have looked at has shown is that cancer in ancient Egypt was really extremely rare. And people say, oh, well, the ancient Egyptians died of other things first. Well, there are two answers to this. Yes, they did die sooner in many cases, but they did have other diseases that were related to relative old age. And also, there's a lack of evidence of childhood cancers in ancient Egypt as well. Now, if cancer was there in large numbers, it would be evident in the remaining skeletal and mummified remains, and it's not. So you then have to ask the question, why is it not there, and why is it so much prevalent in the modern world?
Mm. That leads me to my next question, is what did your studies of cancer in ancient history suggest about the disease in the modern world?
Well, we left it as an open question, but I mean, you would have to consider the lack of smoking in ancient Egypt, possibly the diet, pollution, a whole range of factors that we have today, which were not there in not just in ancient Egypt, but in antiquity generally. You get an increase in cancer from the Industrial Revolution onwards. So it is to some extent that people didn't live as long, of course, but there are other factors there as well.
My conversation with Professor David will continue in part two, in which we discuss diseases that affected the ancient Egyptians, the Amarna royal mummies, and her career as an Egyptologist. First, let's get that pesky automated advertising out of the way. See you in a moment.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
And now, part two of my conversation with Professor Anne Rosalie David. Now, we move to the Amarna period and the mummies of the royal family. There have been various studies of these bodies, and they have many controversies. Professor David weighs in.
So, at the time that we are recording this, the History of Egypt podcast is laboriously covering the later years of Akhenaten. And this era was the subject of a rather, we'll say, famous study regarding the DNA relationships of late 18th dynasty royal mummies. But that publication, or that study and the methodology, prompted many challenges and concerns about its findings. And as someone who has experience with long-term studies of mummified remains and the possibility of identifying ancient DNA, what is your experience of DNA viability in mummified remains?
There are considerable problems with DNA identification. This has been known for many years. One of the main things, of course, is contamination by later handling, or even people working with the mummy at the time of the sampling. And we have found that you really have to take samples from deep within the mummy. Tissue surface samples are really no good because they can have been exposed to all sorts of contaminants, or to go inside a tooth. That is another possibility. So you can, to some extent, get round the contamination if these criteria are observed. Also, the techniques themselves have much improved, and our researchers, colleagues here in Manchester, have developed a much more viable methods, if you like. But it is a very difficult area. And you have to look at all the surrounding information, historical data as well, to begin to see whether you are in fact on the right track. You have additional problems, of course, where the family you're looking at, the family group, are so interrelated from historical evidence. So that's another issue, and it's fraught with difficulties, really.
So, on a professional Egyptological level, what is or was your assessment of that study and its conclusions?
Well, I think one of the other problems is that it's only possible at the moment to identify mitochondrial DNA, which is from the mother. The nuclear DNA, it's not, which is from the father. So this again poses another lot of problems. And I'm sure the study is a baseline for development, but there will undoubtedly, hopefully, be further studies as techniques improve and develop. I think with all our work, we can never say we've reached the final conclusion. We found with mummies in Manchester, we've gone back. We had the two brothers in our collection, and the historical evidence, the inscriptions, suggested that they were brothers, half-brothers probably with different fathers. But none of the earlier studies showed this up. And then a couple of years ago, another study was undertaken, and this provided really very convincing evidence that they are half-brothers from the mother. It's one of the things that makes it an exciting subject is that there's no final word almost on anything. It looks to the future.
Yes. And that actually brings me to something that I meant to talk about but haven't included in my questions here, is the two brothers that you mentioned and the studies of them. I personally was not familiar with these two individuals, and I'm guessing many of my listeners are not. Are you able to introduce us to who these two brothers were, and when did they live, and what was the context of their discovery?
Yes, they are a wonderful highlight in the development of biomedical Egyptology. They were discovered in Egypt in a joint tomb buried together in the beginning of the 20th century by Sir William Flinders Petrie. He had a very close relationship with Manchester. Many of his excavations were funded by a Manchester textile manufacturer, a man called Jesse Howarth. Okay. And when Petrie found this tomb, the whole tomb group, all the equipment, everything in it, the coffins, the bodies, the whole lot, came to Manchester. So we have the whole tomb group, which is very unusual, in the Manchester Museum. Now, these brothers were unwrapped in the early part of the 20th century by one of the pioneers of biomedical Egyptology, Dr. Margaret Murray. And she was curator of Egyptology at the museum. And she gathered together a multidisciplinary team of medics and scientists, which was revolutionary then, and they had a proper scientific study on these mummies. So that's who they are. They were from a local elite family at a place called Reefa in Middle Egypt. They lived in the 12th Dynasty, Middle Kingdom, so around 1900 BC. One was a priest in the local temple, and the other one was not. But they were so physically different. It was even in Margaret Murray's report in 1910. It said, you know, they cannot be full brothers because they are so dissimilar. And there were all sorts of speculation about this, whether one was adopted into the family or whether they were actually half-brothers. In the inscriptions, they give the name of the mother as the same person, but the fathers, seemingly, although they're not named, they seem to be different people. So, and there's a big age gap between them. Okay. So this was the sort of main, and it's very good with DNA to have a specific question. It's not really to do random DNA, it's almost pointless. But if you've got a historical question you can ask, that's where it has its real strength, if you like.
And what was the conclusion of the restudy? Are they brothers or half-brothers or cousins?
The evidence shows that in all probability, we also have to say this, they are sons of the same mother, but that their the fathers were probably different. Of course, we don't have the nuclear, the father's DNA, but they had a common mother.
Fascinating. I will have to go back into my Middle Kingdom episodes and add a section on these two, because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, there's a book on it, which I wrote a few years ago, but also now there are papers, of course, on the DNA, the recent DNA, yeah.
Ah, excellent. That's good. I like a new topic for research. Thank you very much. So a couple of quick or light-hearted questions, if you're comfortable with them. For 99.9% of the population, myself included, our experience of mummies tends to be from a museum or a museum storeroom, usually sealed within a nice glass case. So I'm curious about your physical experience of handling mummies and just a couple of little aspects. So for example, how much does a wrapped mummy tend to weigh?
Well, this is an open question really, because some mummies are quite lightweight, some mummies are extremely heavy, and it really depends on how much material is with the mummy in the wrapping, particularly bitumen resin. And looking at the Manchester collection again, there's one mummy belonging to a woman called Perimbast, which is so heavily resonated that the mummy is stuck to the under coffin. And so whenever that's moved around or taken for x-ray or whatever, it is extremely heavy. So they vary considerably, but the lightest are easily liftable, but the heaviest are very heavy. And the people involved in the actual moving of mummies, which I've never personally been, will experience everything from a mummy that is easy to move right through to one that is extremely difficult.
Is there any relationship between the quality of mummification and the weight?
Not really. It's more dependent on, as I say, whether they are impregnated heavily with bitumen, or whether what sort of amulets are between the wrappings. These all add, of course, to the weight. If the mummy is very basic and just wrapped in bandages, then it's not going to be so heavy.
And what does an unwrapped mummy smell like?
Well, they have their distinctive bouquets, if you like, dependent very largely on the type of spices and ingredients that were used in the packing. I could go, when I worked at the museum, into the store, and I could almost close my eyes and smell which mummy it was, because they had quite distinctive aromas. Very pleasant. I mean, there's nothing unpleasant about them. But they retain that smell after, thousands of years.
And according to archaeologists that I've spoken to, when excavating a area that turns out to have a mummy, apparently there is it is very clear before the mummy is uncovered that there actually is a mummy in the vicinity, because apparently it's the smell seeps into the sand or the soil and begins to rise as you uncover it. Have you ever experienced this?
I haven't, no, but it sounds very likely, yes.
I have it on good authority. Unfortunately, it's never happened to me, because I've only excavated temples, but I am looking forward to that experience one day, I think. And what is the texture of a unwrapped mummy's skin?
Again, it depends upon the method of mummification and how successful it was. So some mummies have very fragile, friable tissue. The two brothers, for example, there was virtually no tissue left on the mummies after Margaret Murray's unwrapping. But some of them, I mean, another mummy in the collection, Asru, she's been unwrapped since the middle 19th century when she came to the museum, and she was unwrapped before this. Now, the tissue there is firm. She was obviously very well mummified, and she's been kept in good conditions, of course, environmental conditions, and so the tissue there is hard but firm. So it depends on the method of mummification, what has happened to the mummy in the meantime, and to some extent, of course, now the environmental conditions in which they're kept.
So the popular image of the sort of friable, papery, leathery skin is context dependent.
Yes, absolutely. Yes,
absolutely. So moving now to your work generally as an Egyptologist and your career, I'm very curious what first drew you to Egyptology as a field of personal interest, and then what inspired you to choose it for your professional career?
Well, when I was a child of 6 years of age, we had a talk at school, and the teacher showed a line drawing of three pyramids. I now know that these were the Abu Sir pyramids, the famous reconstruction drawing of them. Then, of course, I didn't know. But that was it. I knew I wanted to be an Egyptologist. And I went home to my parents, didn't know the word Egyptology, but that's what I want to do. So I've never changed my mind. The whole of my life, if you like, since then was focused on trying to achieve that. And I went to a school where we were fortunate enough to be able to do not just Latin, but also ancient Greek. So I chose my degree course and my university, which was University College London, where you could do Egyptology all those years ago in the 1960s as part of a major part of an ancient history degree. So then I went on to do my research, PhD research, on how the ancient Egyptians used the temple as a ritual unit. And then I worked at the Petrie Museum in London for 9 months. And then the beginnings of my career at Manchester started in 1972, when I went to Manchester to look after the Egyptology collection at the University Museum. And then we built up on the mummy project over the years. And back in the early part of this century, we had this really great opportunity to set up a special centre for biomedical Egyptology, which is the only place in the world where you can study it as a discipline and do a special degree in it. And so I went there to head up the centre.
Excellent. So a lifelong passion that just kept building. And looking back at your time in Egyptology, how do you feel the field has changed?
Oh, I think it's changed tremendously. When I started out, Egyptology was really the study of the language, the hieroglyphs, and the history, and that really was it, with some of the archaeology, of course, which was also important. But over the decades, Egyptology, in a way, has caught up with other archaeological disciplines, because whereas other kinds of archaeology without a lot of literature were focused much earlier on the archaeological and the bio-archaeological aspects, Egyptology, we all tended to focus so much on the very important language studies. But increasingly, you can see that scientific analyses have come into the field. And of course, in our field, biomedical Egyptology, it's grown enormously over the past 20 to 30 years.
Mm. And looking forward, are there any paths of inquiry that you would particularly like researchers to take in the future?
Yes, in our department, in our centre, we're developing a new technique in its application to mummified remains, which is called proteomics, and it will be hopefully an alternative method of identifying disease in mummies without all the problems I've described which relate to DNA. Manchester is a world centre for modern patients in this field, and it's been possible so far to show that this technique can be applied to ancient mummified tissue. So this is going to be something to watch with really hopefully very exciting results in the future. The other thing I think which is important is large-scale studies on human remains. So many of the studies, ours included, are focused on individual mummies or maybe on museum collections, but there's huge scope there for looking at large numbers of mummies, which I'm sure is something that Egypt itself will develop in the coming decades, because then you begin to get these patterns of disease that you can translate into a context for modern disease. Because this is one of the other things that we're really keen on in Manchester, is providing ancient evidence to look at why and where and if a disease has developed down to the modern day.
Mm. Goodness, that sounds fascinating. Very, very exciting avenue of research. Goodness.
It is. It's really one of the ways of the future for Egyptology.
Mm. Particularly that idea of being able to do quantitative studies of human remains rather than just very focused small selection. Excellent. Oh, that's exciting. Now, my last question is one that I ask of every interviewee, and it sort of gives an insight into different personalities and thoughts and perspectives on the past. My question is, if you could look back and definitively answer one question or issue from ancient Egyptian history, what would you choose and why?
Well, one of the things, and I think it's probably inspired, if you like, by our current circumstances, but before that, one of the things that has always interested me is why the particular kingdoms of ancient Egypt seemingly collapsed so suddenly. Now, I know there are political, economic, maybe even religious reasons why this happened. But increasingly, you have to ask the question, and the evidence is not there at present, but was there some kind of major disease occurrence that in fact triggered this? I mean, looking at what's happening around the world today, you'd see all these, these major industries and economic structures collapsing because of a disease process. And I wonder whether there was something of that, at least in some of these collapses. I mean, the interesting evidence from the pyramid workman's village at Cahoon, we have, as you know, about half the objects from the site in the Manchester Museum. The interesting thing there is that the population, which is Middle Kingdom, suddenly, apparently, disappeared. And yet, things that were left behind included the workmen's tools. And if they'd gone to another building site, these they certainly would have taken with them. So there is a certain amount of evidence that they left quickly. Now, was that an epidemic? There were baby burials excavated at Cahoon in the 1890s by Flinders Petrie, and these were distributed to museums around the world. One came to Manchester and it deteriorated in the 1930s and was disposed of. But there are other baby mummies, if you like, from Cahoon out there. If anyone in the world has them, we'd be grateful to know, because those babies might be a clue as to the kind of diseases that might have been there. So that's my question. Basically, did disease, and particularly epidemic disease, have any major input and impact on the collapse of the kingdoms?
Well, fascinating. That's a very specific answer. I like that a lot. It's very interesting to see how people respond to that question. That's a very good answer. I like that. So, Professor David, that brings me to the end of my questions. Thank you very much for coming on the show to answer them. Absolutely fascinating. I'm sure many of my listeners will be really intrigued. I hope you've enjoyed yourselves, and thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it enormously, and it's a great opportunity, thank you, to be able to share some aspects of our work with the wider Egyptology community.
Excellent. And I hope you'll consider coming on the show in future to talk about perhaps Takaboti and your next publication or future research as well.
I'd be delighted to do that. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the History of Egypt podcast, and special thanks to Professor David for speaking with us. Next week, our narrative resumes with the reign of King Tutankhaten, better known as Tutankhamun. See you soon.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for The French Revolution today.